This is the Pedestrian Podcast.
I don't know. That's just what pedestrian, average, mediocre receivers do. What's up? My man Deion Sanders, we all right, huh? We all right? Yeah, we all right. We're going to go to the Super Bowl again, being all right.
The official podcast of the UK Seahawkers. Here are your hosts, Stuart Court.
Le'Veon Bell wants to be paid as an offensive weapon, when if you're the Steelers, he's come across as a bit of a weapon himself in different ways.
And Adam Nathan.
It's tricky because Hugh Jackson said nothing for me to shove him in.
We are going to follow you. You lead us, okay? Like I told you before, you lead us to darkness, we will follow you.
Go Hawks.
Wow, these Seahawks in 2018 are sure trying their hardest and damnedest to make things interesting. Welcome to another episode of the Pedestrian Podcast, still the one, only, and official UK Seahawkers podcast. This week we will discuss all the wild happenings in the Queen City in Charlotte in North Carolina on Sunday evening, as well as look ahead to the first of the big three, although somewhat you'd hope to be comfortable three remaining NFC West divisional games the Seahawks have on their schedule as they face the 49ers and a familiar face back at CenturyLink Field. But as always, myself, Stuart Court, on the Pedestrian Podcast, is joined by Adam Nathan. How are we, sir?
I am good. Another glorious night watching the mighty Spurs has happened, and wasn't going to record the podcast. Thought, just go to bed, get some kit. But I'm still buzzing from the win. So let's spin, because why not?
Yeah. So the Seahawks went coast to almost coast, as I say, to Charlotte and the Bank of America Stadium, which I think is what it's still called, and faced Cam Newton, Christian McCaffrey, and the Carolina Panthers. The Panthers enter the game in a similar situation to the Seahawks, trying their hardest but probably ultimate failing to keep their tabs on the leading team in that division, obviously the Saints for the Panthers and the Rams for our Seahawks. And it was a pretty exciting, pretty fun and pretty enjoyable game for the Seahawks. This is how it sounded on the Fox broadcast on Sunday evening.
In trouble, escape throws, wide open, it's Matt in the fullback, inside the five, and decked at the one, does he get in? No.
A surprise, first and goal, Carson, not a surprise, working, touchdown Seattle. Teams exchanging penalties, it's a first down, fake to McCaffrey, Newton going for it, oh, intercepted, it's McDougal. Great play by Bradley McDougal, who tipped it to himself. By McDougal, and now Seattle with Carson. Oh, my goodness, he landed on his feet. He's still up.
In this play, Carson goes full flip and stays on his feet.
Man. Down and long, it's a blitz, it's picked up. Wilson going deep, he's got a man wide open, it's Moore. Makes the catch, and a move inside the 20. Wilson, time, firing, it is caught. And down at the one. That looked close. Lockett made the kick.
And here it comes from Pete Carroll.
The touchdown right there.
That will be a touchdown.
No doubt.
And look at him. And then he breaks the ankles.
Wait, it's the Allen Iverson in the
he
finals.
He does exactly what. And then stepped over him.
He stepped over Tyron Lue.
Poor Tyron. Tough.
And we are tied. So Pam Blitz picked up. Wilson going for it. Oh!
The confidence it takes on fourth and three to throw the ball downfield. But this is a matchup that you knew that he liked.
Graham Gano, good on all three from 50-plus this year. Snap and hold are good. The kick is up. It is no good! It's the leg. Here's Wilson. Pressure up the middle. Wilson stands in. Throw deep. He's got Lockett wide open. He's got it! Tyler Lockett got behind the coverage. And the Seahawks win it here in Carolina. What a victory.
The first of what are must-win games pretty much from here until the end of the 2018 season. Come out with a pretty improbable, definitely for certain points of that first quarter, that the first couple of drives for the Panthers. 30-27 win, really dampening the Panthers' player hopes, but doing nothing but boost confidence, morale, and their own playoff hopes. We say it was enjoyable, but it was somewhat a surprising scoreline, all things considered, before the game and obviously then during the game and in that first half, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, I always find it difficult to watch the games on Game Pass on the laptop. You're behind real time if you play, which I really hate. You know that something's happened, you know, and I actually had David Moore's touchdown completely ruined by accidentally switching over to social media and seeing that we'd scored and it was still kind of third and three on my screen, which is a bit frustrating. But I kind of never felt like I was fully into it from a excitement standpoint, because at some point I just thought eventually these guys are going to run away from us and score.
Yeah.
I really don't like the term bend but don't break defense. I think it's overused, but it really got to a stage on Sunday where, you know, giving up all those yards but being so good in the red zone, you know, what Carolina really should have scored about 45 points, but we managed to limit them to 27 with a few really impressive defensive plays.
Yeah.
That is what bend but don't break defense means. And it was only when we got down to the last 5 minutes, I thought, hang about, they can't run away from us here. We've got half a chance.
Yeah, it was one of them, because obviously, I mean, there was, what was it, three red zone, the first three red zone trips only brought about 3 points, I think. Well, maybe that might not be true, but I can't remember. Yeah,
certainly a turnover on downs and then a field goal with the first two.
Yeah, and I'm not certain much happened on the third one. Maybe it was the third one I saw that graphic and they were just preemptively cursing that drive. The Panthers, though, did amass all of the yards. But before we get onto the defensive side of the ball for the Seahawks on Sunday, the offense, as it has been the case for so many of the last 7-8 years, has all come down to RW3, because he's clearly QB1, and he was at his very, very best. So now, I said to you and a few other guys and anyone who'd listen after the game that I can't remember many better performances from Russell Wilson in the situation he found himself in on the road, early kickoff, and he was just incredible on Sunday, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was amazing. And another game that ticks by that he throws 30 times, but mysteriously doesn't get mentioned when we win, when he throws 30 times. Only when we lose and he throws 30 times is it always brought out that, you know, this team can't win when Wilson throws more than 30 times. So that's a nice little bit of revisionism that's being brushed under the carpet, which I always like to see. I love a bit of pettiness, if nothing else, so that's all good. He was magnificent. He was making throws all over the place, throwing to anyone that will take it. Trey Madden, for goodness sake, you know, nearly scoring a touchdown. And, you know, just little things like the throw to David Moore is majestic. And the little pump, the double move by Tyler Lockett to free him, that's just vintage Wilson. And the guy's just got absolute stones. Whatever you think of him, and there will be a game like the Rams where he might have a little bit of a brain fart at the end, maybe trying to make something happen. But there's not that many guys you'd rather have in that situation than Wilson.
No, he was 22 for 31, 339 yards, two touchdowns, and ran three times for just 4 yards. Somehow his longest is seven, something six. Come to that. But I mean, those 90 completions, obviously there's one really bad overthrow on Doug Baldwin yet again in the end zone, which this week ended up with Doug Baldwin getting lit up by the safety by the Panthers. But of the other eight, one of them was a spike to stop the clock before the Seabass game went. I literally can't think of I think one of them was a throw which Mike Davis probably should have got his feet in bounds. He was that much on the money on Sunday. And I think we kind of come to a collective decision that probably the Bears, his rookie year, is up there, and Philly in 2014, I think, was the other one you suggested.
Yeah.
But yeah, but the whole situation, I mean, the pressure on him, because for once, Chris Carson said after the game that the Panthers were calling out their play, they were predicting the run plays before they happened, which is another matter entirely. But the fact that it was put on him, and the five consecutive drives to finish the game all ending in scores, is all on Russell Wilson. And he was as you said, with all the 30 attempt stuff, it seems to have gone under the radar somewhat over the weekend. Obviously, Sam, his biggest fan on Twitter, Hawk Badger, whatever his name is, he said it'll be a travesty if he doesn't win NFC Player of the Week or Air Player of the Week or whatever they have, what awards they have. And he's, for once, he's actually on the money, because everything leading up to the game was discounted that was going to happen, but the fact it did was just incredible. Obviously, the fourth down catch, the throw, his sidestep to give himself a few more seconds, which was basically the game with a deep to Tyler Lockett, the earlier throw to David Moore, the touchdown throw. He just lasers it in to Tyler Lockett, who's on the goal line as well. It was vintage RW3. Talking of the run game, though, Chris Carson led the way with snaps, carries and yards, 55 yards on 16 rush attempts, one goal line touchdown. But as and Mike Davis chipped in with four carries, 14, and Rashad Penny 4 yards on four carries himself. But Chris Carson, I mean, the highlight, the viral play of the week, I saw American gymnast tweet, I saw a British wrestler who's in Japan, he tweeted the video of it. I mean, how did he land on his feet, Adam?
It was insane. I actually always kind of thought and said to friends that if the hurdle at some will be banned, because it is incredibly dangerous if you get just knocked like that and it throws you off what you're doing. But I have no idea how he managed to stick the landing. I mean, that's the kind of thing that, you know, you break your ankle because you just fall slightly in the wrong way. But thankfully, he managed to pull it off.
Yeah, well, it's not the fact that he landed on his feet. It's like he landed on his feet and his knee didn't touch the ground. He just happened to get tackled, like, immediately. But he was still live.
He was still active, yeah.
Still active. He just got absolutely incredible. But just it wasn't his day, but he still had, including that spiral pirouette landing thing he did, he still had a few pretty impressive runs. And he's, again, clearly the lead back of the three, isn't he, Adam?
Yeah, 100%. And in a way, you know, it's quite nice to win a game where you're not having to rely on the run game, or, you know, I don't think the run game has been quite as significant this year to wins as many have. I think it's been complementary to great quarterback play, but it's quite nice that you have a game where you can say, do you know what, this was about the passing game, and you can have a bit more faith in the passing game to make it work. So I don't think it's that bad a thing that the run game didn't really get going this week, because it's nice to, you know, ultimately all of the good teams are multifaceted, and if that's what we want to be, it's nice to know that we can do it both ways, which is great.
Yeah, and obviously the main recipients of the passes from Russell Wilson on Sunday were, in particular, the big plays come from David Moore, with obviously the fourth and three. Just as I said on things on Twitter or maybe on WhatsApp, it was like watching Randy Moss that play, how he just used his body, he initiated contact in the DB and just held on to it just quite long, so it wasn't a pass interference against him, and just perfectly left his hands down by his side until the very last moment to not give the DB an opportunity to get his hands and break the ball. It was just absolute perfection, that play. He finished the game with 4 catches on 5 targets, 103 yards, and that score. And then, obviously, the other guy, Tyler Lockett, 107 yards on 5 catches and a score for himself. Tyler Lockett, as we said, is now got his career best, 8th touchdown in the season, and he's now just three yards and 8 catches away from getting career highs in those two categories again. But in a game which it sounds like Doug Baldwin 100% again, it's good that those two guys again stepped up in his place, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, you have to be able to sling it all over the field, otherwise you become way too easy to stop. So you had to hope Lockett was going to end up being like this, otherwise you wouldn't have paid him $10 million a year or so. And I guess David Moore has become what you hope Brandon Marshall would be. So they probably went into the season thinking that there was enough there. And I think it was our mate Will said, or it may have been you that said that, you know, David Moore is kind of showing why Dwight Freeney was cut last year to keep David Moore on the roster, because he looks an incredible asset and a guy that would probably be twins worse off without, yeah, if we didn't have him. So it's great to see. And you have to hope that as the season goes on, Wilson, who's a real kind of relationships guy, and he does throw it, you know, he does like throwing to his guys. You have to hope that as they have more reps, that can improve and the relationships grow stronger and stronger.
Yeah, and Malik Turner come up from the practice squad and had his first catch in his NFL career. Nick Vanette made some pretty important, a couple on third down as well, grabs, as his eight Dixon's pretty quiet in his return to Carolina, but I think he had a couple of grabs as well. So everyone did their bit, and including number 89, who was quite clearly, it sounds like, hobbled on Sunday. He did his usual, and as I said, he should have had a touchdown if Russell Wilson gets that ball away a heartbeat sooner and a little bit lower.
Vanette's been really impressive the last month.
Nick Vanette, I don't know what it is. He I know you compare him to Cooper Halfitt, but he looks like a slightly lesser. Zach Miller was just did everything to a pretty decent to good level. Nick Winnett has done that over the last, well, this season, really, especially since Will Disley got injured in Arizona.
Do you reckon he could handle, like, 8 targets a game?
I'd imagine so, but I don't think, I mean, we kind of saw all the hand-wringing over Jimmy Graham the last few years. I don't think that's going to be a massive part of the offense in the past. They're never going to be target number one on plays. I don't think anything we've seen in the last few years has shown that. We didn't do it. We had a cheat code at tight end. I mean, you kind of second guess why they give all that money to Ed Dixon over such a long period of time, if that's the case. But I think he'd be able to take it if anything happened to, say, a Baldwin or a David Moore. So he could be like that third wide receiver if they use Dixon different ways if that happens. But I think he could. I think he's took his opportunity. I think he kind of, Disley kind of maybe lit a fire under him, which is kind of what players like that kind of need, because he kind of knew his place with Luke Wilson and Jimmy Graham were in town, and he now knows his place, and now you'd hope has the confidence he can do it, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, like, we don't run a lot of screens for whatever reason, but you kind of feel like off play action, you could dump it off to Vinette, have a couple of blockers in front. He'd probably pick you up 15, 20 yards. Like, he's athletic. He's got, I know we've briefly kind of likened him to someone like George Kittle, but from a physicality point of view, he's got that type of body.
Yeah, it will be interesting, but I think also he's now building up the trust with Wilson, with the coaches, with Pete Carroll, that he would be able to do that. So obviously we do kind of hope at the same time that he isn't asked to do that, because that would mean other things have gone wrong elsewhere, wouldn't it?
Yeah, although, again, all of these good teams managed to find a way to get their tight end involved. So as the other option, especially as, you know, I imagine whenever teams see us bring in a heavy set, you know, go to three tight end, one back personnel, they're thinking run. You know, if you can run a play action there and dump it off to him, you know, you could be in line for a really big play off that.
Yeah, that's true. It will be interesting, but I do think trust is there, confidence is there in himself and from the quarterback throwing the ball as well. So he's definitely earned the right to get that trust. It's just the case if the situation ever allows. Some offensive stats come out of the game.
It's a bit of Nick Vinette chat, 10 to 12, on a Wednesday night. Who would have thought?
So some offensive stats after that game. Russell Wilson's passer rating over the past 7 games is frankly ridiculous. 132.5, 125.4, 158.3, 89.2, 123.2, 110.3, and 128.3. There's been a lot of chat on the Ringer and the guys over at The Athletic about how worthless passer rating, QB rating is in the 2018 version of the NFL, but those numbers so consistently high is that just shows what kind of level Wilson is playing at, as we said earlier, Adam.
Yeah, 100%. I think one of the big things that I don't like about passer rating, which I think is valid, is that it doesn't account for any yards after the catch, which I think, like, Mariota had a 61-yard touchdown, which had 59 yards after the catch, which does seem a bit ridiculous. But I think with all of these statistics, a lot of them don't tell the whole story, but it's a pretty good way to build up an initial case for your story. So I don't know how you can look at any stat and say, you know, if you looked at the stats, you'd say, oh, it seems like Wilson's playing well. And then I think if you then watch the tape, that would kind of back up what the stats have been saying, and vice versa.
Yeah, and also after Sunday, Russell Wilson's QB rating for his career went back above 100, which means only him and Aaron Rodgers have a career QBR of over 100. He also passed Dave Craig for the most regular season franchise win with his 71st win on Sunday, which is pretty impressive. And if you look at the QB stats all time for the Seahawks and look at how many games it took Messrs. Craig, Hasselbeck and Zorn to get the numbers they amassed and compiled, Russell Wilson's going to blow those out of the water by the time he is done on the defensive.
I think also, if I'm not mistaken, he is one win away from having the most quarterback wins inside seven after his first 7 seasons. And he already holds the record for most quarterback wins after 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 seasons. So it's quite a cool record to have.
Yeah.
And I think only Ben Roethlisberger has more rookie wins than he had.
I think 4 and 5, he passed Matt Ryan as well. I think that was Matt Ryan who he beat. But defensively, though, it wasn't all good. 0 sacks from the defensive line or pass rush unit. 470 yards given up which is a season high for this team against the Panthers team, which had won 10 straight. Cam Newton only had 5 incompletions, went 25 for 30. Christian McCaffrey had 227 yards and 2 touchdowns. Carolina had the ball inside the Seahawks red zone 7 times, fumbled the ball 5 times, which Seattle record 0 of. But the defense, for all that, as you said, they stepped up with 1 or 2 or 3, if you include Dance Jones's third down tackle and Christian McCaffrey early doors. Big play. So as you said, the big plays came at the big moments. But apart from that, it was slightly worrying, wasn't it, on the defensive side?
Yeah, I mean, you've got Trey Flowers' tackle, which is the match-winning play of the game, really, forcing them to kick that long field goal. I think it's difficult to be too critical of the defense because they are fairly bereft of talent. And I think if you watch that game, my takeaway from it is if we played the Saints, they could score 60 points against us, because not only would they be able to get from back to front as quickly as Carolina did, they're just much more clinical in the red zone. And I think we were pretty fortunate that I thought some of their play calling in the red zone was a bit ticky-tack. And also, as much as we absolutely lauded Cam Newton last week, rightly so, I think he's a great quarterback, he's never been best when you've got 20 players inside 20 yards versus inside 60 yards of field, where, you know, it gets all a bit congested for him and he doesn't necessarily pick the right pass, or at that stage, and his accuracy lets him down a little bit in that situation. So, as I say, I think this was one of the few examples where bend but don't break defense is a valid way to call it. But ultimately, I think Brian Baldinger did a brilliant little thing on his tape breakdown of the 3 plays that won the game, and we won all 3 of those games. Those plays, it was the 4th down stop on Cam, it was the Naz Jones tackle, and it was also Trey Flowers. And I just think in the biggest moments, we managed to step up and force them off their perch a bit, and it, you know, that was ultimately the difference between winning and losing.
Yeah, I mean, the Trey Flowers play, especially because he got worked on Sunday by DJ Moore, the rookie first rounder for them. He had 8 catches for 91 yards. He got worked underneath, a few over the top. DJ Moore's only for 20 yards, but he seems to be the most coachable DB. I mean, we kind of, obviously, Shaquille Griffin chased down Christian McCaffrey, but just ridiculously. I think it's the fastest recorded player so far this year, or something I saw from Dugas' Twitter earlier. But he just seems really coachable. I think Pete Carroll raved about him on 710 on Monday as well. But the fact that he was able to trail DJ Moore and just, it was kind of, he kind of wanted to take the completion and just be there for the tackle, was a pretty impressive open field where DJ Moore would have iced the game to a certain extent, but definitely would have got 10 or 15 more yards than he did. And I think he only got 4 or 5 on that catch. It was a proper, proper impressive play from a guy who was not only a fifth round draft pick, but a safety for his entire collegiate career. And he's been one of the bright spots of the, not just the Seahawks defense, but the 2018 season, hasn't he?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, that play, as you say, he trails David Moore about 30 yards across the field. I mean, he played that like you expect Sherman is primed to play it. Off the right corner position, and he tackles him kind of in the slot on the left-hand side. It was an amazing play, and as you say, he didn't overcommit trying to win the ball. He was happy for the completion to happen and make the tackle. Like, that was just great situational football. And, I mean, people are saying now they think he might already be better than Shaq Griffin, which I think might be a little bit of a push. But he's showing incredible progress for a guy who's, like, 6 games into his actual career.
Yeah, it is quite daft and also pretty exciting what the Seahawks could have going forward on both sides of the secondary on the outside, obviously opposite Shaquille Griffin. Obviously, the guy in the middle, though, was there yet again, leading the team in tackles, 11 tackles on Sunday. Only player on the field who got more tackles than him was the guy who's probably LB2 in the NFL. Luke Kuechly finished with 12, Bobby Wagner 11, and I think the play which especially Mike Dugard blew his mind was the one where he took on two of three Carolina Panthers and managed to stop, I think it was Christian McCaffrey, before he got to the first down. He was there again and also seemed to be covering the tight ends a bit more on Sunday, which was interesting.
He has been incredible this season. I almost think that in playing in a slightly worse team with less people covering around him making great plays as well, his ability has really come to the fore. because he's kind of having to make plays, and he's making plays that guys around him just aren't capable of doing. He stonewalled Cam Newton on that 4th and 2. Yeah. I mean, I think it probably was a generous spot for us, and it probably was a first down.
Yeah,
but still, to stop Cam Newton in his tracks and basically not give him any push is a ridiculous sign of strength.
Yeah, I think he gives up 3 inches and about 15 pounds to Cam Newton as well. That's just me pulling numbers out of the air, but I'm pretty certain that's the case. Yeah, he's the best linebacker. He's the best player in the position. He's one of the best defensive players. And yet again, it's another year where he's compiling tackles and stats and numbers and film and just doesn't seem to be getting any national traction, which is just, it's just a bit annoying, really, because he is definitely, he's the best defensive player on this team. So, and it's, yeah, we massively need him with the issues elsewhere at the linebacker position this year. After the Sunday, though, the Seahawks now won 11 of their past 17 road games, which kick off at 10 o'clock Pacific time. And it was a game where Tyler Lockett did not return a single kickoff. He almost seemed bored by the fact he had to stand back there and just watch the ball go over his head. And as the game, we talk about defensive plays, but the biggest one, we've spent most of our lives, Adam, knowing that Scotsmen can't kick footballs. They can't kick American footballs either, can they?
No, we all knew it. I mean, if you'd said you were sending Stephen Fletcher and Kenny Miller out to take a penalty, you'd dump yourself. You know, they're going to sky it high and wide. So I don't know what you expect. Funny enough, you make a football comparison. You know when you've been to football games where you've been the better team, but you've just missed chance after chance after chance. And eventually you look at your mate who you've gone with and you think, you know what's going to happen here, they're going to score. That's kind of how I feel on the reverse this game was for a Seahawk and Carolina fan, because they must have thought after the first quarter, like, this is going to be just an easy dance. They're red zone after red zone after red zone, missed chance, missed chance, missed chance. And I wonder how many of their mates would have turned to each other and just thought, it's going to be one of those days, isn't it? Because that's exactly how it felt to me on Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, also the 5 fumbles, not one of them was recovered by the Seahawks. That's some weird fumble risky look, which is just seems to be the thing for the Seahawks, doesn't it, over the last few years. One other thing for the game on Sunday, Tyler Lockett's touchdown, which was delayed by a challenge by Pete Carroll, because Tyler Lockett was ruled down, but he obviously was in the end zone, was his celebration. But, like, I'm not a massive NBA fan, but I've always been so interested and fascinated and enjoyed the Allen Iverson story. That is a pretty cool celebration, wasn't it? Doing the Iverson over Tyronn Lue step over.
Yeah, and the people that do love their basketball were going wild about that celebration. So obviously it was, I don't know, a bit like doing a Shearer or maybe a Robbie Fowler little sniff up and down the line. In terms of its iconic nature, maybe it was something like that. But it did seem very cool. And watching, when you watch the two videos side to side, it was giving. They've stepped their game up on the celebrations this year. I'm looking forward to the next one.
Yeah, well, I think Will Blackman, who used to play for Seahawks, watched him in the Super Bowl with the Giants. He tweeted after Eddie Jackson led the Motown choir on Thursday night on Thanksgiving. He goes, he wants to get back playing because this looks like it's so much fun now, obviously. Because he played in a time when celebrations were basically outlawed, thanks to Chad Johnson and the rest of them. But yeah, it was really, really cool. And there's a pretty cool piece on The Athletic by Jason Jenks, who I think he actually got a quote from AI himself on Tyler Lockett's celebration. So it would be interesting. Tyler Lockett said that was the one he was supposed to do in LA, but instead handed the ball off to Floyd Mayweather.
Iverson, bothered by Lue.
How about that?
And steps over Tyronn Lue.
7 straight points. So, a few questions. I don't want to but before we go over them too much, it'd be best to get some of them now. Nick the Greek asks, the biggest single factor for the difference between this season and last? Less injuries, better airline play, no cable, better running back play, better locker room atmosphere. I think it's all of that combined, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the offensive line has to... I don't think you can win without a good offensive line. I think it's kind of that reductive now. And if you look at what's happening with Oakland's offensive line and what happened with our offensive line last year, there being the common denominator, I find it quite difficult to say anything but the fact that losing Tom Cable and replacing with Mike Solari has made an enormous difference. And I think in terms of general play, you're almost foolish to suggest that there's anything that could be more significant than that.
Yeah, I think one thing is that we heard when Cable and Daryl Bevel were fired and Chris Rashad was that firing? He's kind of just like, yeah, thought they changed the locks and them kind of thing. It was a weird thing with Chris Rashad. But I think Pete Carroll's just got guys who are more on his message of Ken Norton. He's worked with pretty much the best part of a decade at USC and obviously Seattle before he went down to Oakland. I think, I mean, it's Mike Solari. He's got people in Shot and Iron especially. He's got people who are coaching underneath him who can pass the message along more consistently than maybe Cable was. And he's, I mean, Cable's coaching. Well, not just what's going on in Oakland, but if you go and watch the Colts play and run the ball, Mark Lewinsky is levelling players since he's been in there for the last four or five weeks in Indianapolis. So it's not just these two parts where the Tom Cable thing. I just think he kind of took back control of the coaching side of it and got back on message, obviously, with some we're going to see this week and other moves they made in the offseason. I do think O-line, but also I think you mentioned the last couple of weeks as well, Ken Norton has got that defense ready to play, and they're playing a pretty high, a pretty excitable level, if that's right, because they just seem to be enjoying every second of it, which didn't seem to be the case for certain people and at certain points last year. And it kind of just seemed like you don't often see shots of Ken Norton, and he looks like a deer in the headlights. You saw that quite a bit with Chris.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I don't like to do this, but the Pedestrian Podcast may have to get in the bin in the sense that we might have to eat a bit of crow here, because we thought it was going to be a negative season, and I don't think in our wildest dreams we could have expected to be in this favourable position going forward. And we may not like exactly how it's all come together, but it's hard to argue with it, unfortunately or otherwise.
No, but I think defensively, Pete Carroll's shown what a ridiculously good coach, especially when you play Trey Flowers, a ridiculously good coach he is. Just coaching, he probably just coaches the basics and just does it to an extremely high level. So I think his kind of, if you want to call it, Hall of Fame credentials has been solidified and certified somewhat by this year. But also, yeah, I think we kind of do have to kind of, okay, fair play. But I don't think anyone saw this coming. I don't think anyone saw a month ago the slate of games and with how the offense was looking, how the defense was looking, and the play, but no KJ Wright, obviously everyone's left from the secondary, pass rush is basically Frank Clark or nothing. So if anyone says they saw this coming, then they're just either always wearing pink rose tinted glasses or they're just lying, basically, because no one saw us being at, I think 76% is our playoff chances as we stand. I think if they beat the Vikings and win the three NFC West games, obviously two against the Niners and the Cardinals at home on week 17, the playoff chances are 99%. I mean, there can't be anyone who saw this coming so quickly. We were saying a month ago that this is a team which looked like they'll be really good next year, but it looks like they're ready to cause some mischief in January this year, Adam, or next season.
Yeah, I mean, do you know what? It's funny you should say that. I think Sean Wilson asked us a question about do we have any lucky pants or superstitions and stuff like that, and I am as superstitious a person as it comes. Like, I'm wearing the same clothes for Spurs tonight that I wore for Chelsea on Saturday. washed, I might add.
I did that for Cov in May when they wouldn't not wore the same, washed again, wore the same shirt and jeans combination and hoodie combination for both playoff final, semi-final legs and the final at Wembley. The only difference being that the playoff final was in like 35 degree heat and I was sweating. So it doesn't always work out the best.
Well, you won all three games, so it does work. But, like, yeah. You know, it was no Maltesers on Saturday at Spurs. We didn't have time, so it's no Maltesers tonight at Spurs, and that's why we won. that's the way it goes. But I said to a couple of mates a couple of days ago that, you know, I think I might be looking to go to Dallas or Chicago for the playoffs. And they said, oh, my goodness, you would never normally say that. You're so superstitious. But I kind of feel like we're playing with house money at the minute. And being in the position we're in, if we don't make the playoffs now, it'll be a disappointment, but it's not going to be a crushing disappointment like it was last year where you were so flat after the Arizona game. Like, if we don't make it this year, you'll be buzzing for next year regardless.
If whenever the season ends, if you hear that Russell Wilson said what he said in the tunnel at Atlanta in his rookie year, you kind of go, okay, yeah, that sounds right. I think we'd all agree with that, and it's not just pie in the sky thinking, because this team, as we said a month ago, looks like, especially if you think Trey Flowers, Shaquille Griffin, and everyone back there. They're going to replenish defensively, if not in the draft, then definitely in free agency with some pretty, you'd expect, banner names and marquee signings as well. So it's everything will be more encouraging than we possibly would have hoped so quickly, and it's just, it is a massive testament to the people who are making decisions who kind of had an off-season where they got lambasted by everyone from all comers, including us two and them.
Yeah, and there were certain things that they deserved to be lambasted for.
Yeah.
But in certain things they've done, you can't really argue. They've been fantastic.
Yeah, they have. And I think John Schneider deserves a hell of a lot of credit because he seems to have absolutely nailed it with the draft, and not just the draft. Obviously, Ed Dixon's come in and been a pretty solid contributor. And they got DJ Fluker on the offensive line. He's been massive. Bradley McDougal, the money they gave him in the offseason seems like an absolute bargain. The way he's playing, his self-tipping interception Sunday was one of the plays we didn't really discuss, but it was a pretty cool play to see from a safety position. We didn't really see much of that from the guy replaced in number 31. He was more of a thumper, but Bradley McDougal seems to be more of a Swiss Army knife, as we said in the past. We're obviously raving about Russell Wilson. Is anyone else who deserves some praise, want to praise on Sunday, Adam?
Well, it was really nice to see Naz Jones fly in and, you know, yeah, make, you know, big contributions.
Only 13 snaps, though.
Strange. That whole thing is very strange.
Yeah, yeah. I'll probably go. I think Trey Flowers deserves, just because he could have been, after what Devontae Adams did to him a week before, and after how the first, well, not maybe not the first quarter, the second and third quarter went, the middle of that part of that game went against DJ Moore, he kind of could have gone to his shell a bit, but he stepped up and didn't, kind of had short-term memory. I made what turned out to be a pretty decisive play. But back on questions, Mark Wilcott asked, what has most impressed you about the Seahawks' play this season, considering we are in a rebuilding year? I just think it's the fact that they have been in every single game and seem to be defensively, especially apart from Sunday. I mean, Sunday's probably the biggest disappointment defensively, isn't it? Even with the two Rams games, because they're doing that to everyone.
Yeah, I think to not even be close to being blown out in any game. And I think, you know, every loss has been one score.
One score, yeah. I think after Sunday, we've won the last five in Carolina to an aggregate score of about 15, I think, as well, which is ridiculous.
Yeah, so I think to be in that situation is pretty incredible, given, you know, a lot of people said, well, I think there wasn't an NFL expert in inverted commas that said we'd even make the playoffs. So if no one thinks you're going to make the playoffs, that means that they think you're not that great, and teams that are not that great get blown out by great teams. So to be in that situation, I think, is incredibly impressive.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Mark also asked, can the Seahawks really go 4-1 to finish regular season? I'm assuming a tight win against the Vikings and a loss to the Chiefs, even though both are in Seattle. Hopefully the three games shouldn't be an issue. Obviously, the game against the Vikings is the most important. It's tiebreakers. Don't know why, but the game in San Francisco is worrying me more than the game against the Vikings.
Yeah, I mean, are we going to need it?
I think if we beat the Vikings, and then, as I said, I think if we beat the Vikings but lose one of the NFC West games, I think it's 84% a playoff thing. So it's not, but it just would be a nice little cushion to have with Niners, Chiefs, Cardinals left after.
I mean, the good thing about San Francisco is there's such an apathy around that team. You know, it doesn't sell out. It's not like, you know, you're almost in a neutral venue at worst with the way that the Seahawks fans travel at the best of times. So
yeah,
you'd have to hope that it'll probably be one of those scrappy kind of 17-12 type games that goes down the end and think, oh, that wasn't a great performance, but you leave with a W and that's kind of all that matters.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Sean asks, any game day rituals you can advise that will 100% work for a Seahawks win this weekend? I think as we've witnessed in the past, Adam, it's getting Mark Jackson on the tallest RV in the park. And
that always, apart from sometimes, works.
I think it's two and one, I think I am in Seattle. Bills, Oakland, that sounds right. Panthers, Bills, Raiders, yeah, 2-1.
Yeah, I think I'm 3-1 in Seattle, and then I think I'm 5-1 in Seahawk games. So, you know, if someone's to pay for my flight, get me out there. That seems a pretty good way. You have to pay off my clients as well, who I'm going to be letting down for catering, but I'm sure we can make that work for a bit of sport, so don't worry about that. So yeah, get the Nathan out there and we'll be flying.
Yeah, and Dave Bailey wants to know what grades would give Norton and Schottenheimer. I think Norton deserves higher thing, because shot number is still really annoying.
Yeah, 100%. I would say A and B.
Ooh, no, I can't give shot number a B.
B minus.
I was gonna go B, C minus.
Do it.
Because we did just give 470 yards. It's the most Seahawks give up in a win since they beat the Texans just over a year ago. But moving on, though, the Seahawks return back to CenturyLink Field this week for the first of basically where they're basically not going to have to leave their home comforts for the rest of the season, as they face Kyle Shanahan and whichever quarterback they're starting this week, and the San Francisco 49ers, and obviously a very familiar face on the defensive side for the Niners.
Kaepernick, end zone, Crabtree. Broken up, picked off! This game is over! Knocked in the air, intercepted by Smith. Off the hands of Richard Sherman. Sherman made the play and Smith was waiting for it.
So yeah, the 2-9 San Francisco 49ers roll into town on the back of a 27-9 defeat down in Florida against Tampa Bay. But this team's season, this team's long-term whatever kind of went out the window week three when Jimmy Garoppolo's knee exploded on the sideline at Arrowhead. You kind of put asterisks next to season if you're a 49ers fan, but if you're an NFL observer. But this team, despite their record, offensively in particular, does things pretty well with someone we've raved about in the past as one of the top offensive play callers in the league, Adam.
Yeah, it's been one of those years for the Niners that, you know, they would have gone into it with so much hope, probably thinking that they could probably be in the record position that the Seahawks are in going into this game. But it just shows the importance of a quarterback. And Garoppolo is a guy that we think can probably make the best of the talent around him. We don't know that for sure, but it was an enormous loss, and it was going to be a lost season the second he went down, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, and this is a team, though, which on the running the ball, especially with mainly Matt Breida, is the number five rushing offense in the NFL. And Matt Breida has amassed, as the page fails to load, 738 yards on the ground with three touchdowns. He's been a bright spark and runs the ball pretty well, especially to the outside, which is going to be probably the main focal point on Sunday for the Seahawks. Defense is stopping Matt Breida, especially after what Christian McCaffrey did last week.
Yeah, I'm kind of always happy if a team's going to come in against Seattle and try and run round us around the side, because I feel like our gap discipline and the speed we have at linebacker has always been so good at stopping that. That if someone was going to come to me and say, how would you like a team to play against you, I would probably say focus on trying to run around the outside of us, because I don't think that's where you're going to get us.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, especially because Trey Flowers, we saw in Arizona when he forced fumble on David Johnson, he isn't scared to line up and hit and tackle. Up receiving for the 49ers, George Kittle is by far away, possibly the healthy best receiver, but definitely whichever quarterback plays, CJ Bettard or Nick.
I think Mullins has the start.
Number one target. George Kittle has 31 more catches than any other 49er on 28 more targets, and he amazingly has nearly 500 more yards than any other 49ers receiver, with 823 yards and three scores. He's like the new era of Gronkowski and Jimmy Graham and that kind of era, as they kind of reach the tail end. He's the next prototype tight end, isn't he? He's in the top upper echelons of tight ends in the league.
Yeah, I think he's definitely in the top five. Gronkowski is probably, his best is done, and he's still probably the best at what he does, but his best is probably gone. And I think, Kittle, Kelsey, and Ertz are probably on the same level as each other, I would say, at this stage.
Yeah, Eifert's kind of never been able to stay healthy.
Awful team as well.
I can't really think of anybody else. I mean, you do kind of have, especially being from the same draft class, obviously four rounds earlier than Kittle went, David Njoku starting to show some flashes with Baker Mayfield. They could be kind of like the next batch. Obviously, you got Antonio Gates still picking up odd yards and touchdowns.
OJ Howard was on for a Pro Bowl season as well, if he didn't get hurt as well.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a pretty cool group, and it's also, for those who give a damn, a pretty cool group coming in next year's draft as well at tight end. So it could be an interesting position. I mean, what in fantasy football terms has been an absolute nightmare position this year. Outside of Marquise Goodwin has a head injury. It sounds pretty questionable. Pierre Garçon obviously has some run-ins with a guy who now he shares a locker room with in the past when he's a Washington Redskin. But it is. You look at the names. Obviously, Dante Pettis is someone we enjoyed watching for the Huskies. And he's had a pretty decent year, if not blowing anything away. He's found the end zone a couple of times, but he's shown some pretty cool route running abilities. But this team on Sunday needs to come in and run the ball to have any chance and then keep Nick Mullins clean, Adam.
Yeah, if they can play it against Oakland, they'll be fine. It's funny you should say that about Pettis. Wide receiver is maybe becoming the position now that needs the most time to, or has the fewest kind of first round rookie stars. You know, you expect so many coming out to be so great, but you know, Corey Davis, there's going to be loads of examples, but it's funny how long it seems to take these wide receivers to really start going, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's, I mean, we've said Gordon Tate's always the one you kind of go back to. We kind of saw it Paul Richardson as well, more close to home. But yeah, there is no Antonio Brown took a couple of years to emerge. The only real rookie class which kind of exploded was probably
Odell
Beckham's class. That's what was Mike Evans in that group as well? I think he was, wasn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, and I think Sammy Watkins was as well.
Yeah, so that was kind of the only one which kind of, in their rookie year in particular, kind of exploded onto the scene.
But, you know, like,
obviously we had Corey Davis and John Ross last year kind of didn't. Corey Davis is showing glimpses, but the offense kind of seems a bit archaic to make the most of his abilities. Corey Coleman's kind of flamed out of the league already. He's bouncing around the practice squad in New England and on the active roster wherever he is now. So yeah, it is a position to watch. But Dante Pettis seems to, he's a pretty high draft pick for where he was probably expected 18 months ago as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best thing about him is his route running. And if you look at the best guys now, you know, it's funny that, you know, Cordarrelle Patterson, who looked so good when he started out, someone interestingly said, you know, Belichick's worked out that, you know, he can't really run any routes, but he's great when you get the ball in his hands, which is why he's kind of playing as a running back at the minute. It's all about that clean route running, and I think Pettis has that. So he's going to be one to look out for on Sunday, because I think him and Mullins, who presumably practice quite a lot because neither one have been getting first team reps, I presume those two will be quite good together.
Yeah, yeah. I think someone's highlighted a few of his routes he ran against the Buccaneers on Sunday. He looks like a poor man's Doug Baldwin again. Did his basketball stuff again on Sunday. On the defensive side, though, before it is a pretty much talent void, but there is, as I keep saying, that familiar face in the form of number 25, Richard Sherman. Richard Sherman, for those who may not know, you may have been living under a rock for the last 8 years, Richard Sherman played 99 games, started 99 games for the Seahawks, 32 interceptions, two pick sixes, and probably gave us the most orgasmic singular moment in Seahawks franchise history, didn't it, with the tip. But despite all that, I mean, you've had Bobby Wagner earlier today, Pete Carroll coming out and saying he shouldn't be booed, and he most definitely shouldn't be, but people are idiots, Adam.
Yeah, I think, you know, sports banter for the sake of awful words will be sports banter for the sake of awful words. Sherman, for me, is, after Marshawn Lynch, the second most influential Seahawk of all time. He gave the defense the swagger that it needed in order to take the jump and be the team they were, which Lynch kind of gave the entire franchise, in my opinion. And yeah, you know, if you want to boo in the second quarter, if he makes a play or if he starts having a go at the ref, you know, you do you. But if I was there, he'd be getting absolutely lauded from the rooftops from me, because he's an all-time team great.
Here's all that you mad bro stuff against Tom Brady in Russell's rookie year, that kind of put this team on the map, and he just did not let them move off the map the whole time. He should still be a Seahawk. It wasn't his decision that he isn't a Seahawk. It was a team decision when they cut him. He didn't ask to be traded to the 49ers. They just traded him. And I think a lot of people point to the fact that he was a locker room cancer, but if you listen to how it seems every single person in that locker room has spoke about him this week and has spoke about him since he left that's not the case at all. Bobby Wagner said he hopes himself gets interception Sunday so he can go and jaw Richard Sherman on the 49ers sideline. Also said that Richard Sherman has a chance of a pick. He's going to run on and break the pass up himself just so he doesn't get one. Adam,
it's great. You know, they're all obviously so close to each other, and Mina Kimes has come up with a great tweet. She said, Richard Sherman was behind the greatest moment in Seahawk football history and embodied the spirit and identity of the team for years. Anyone who boos him isn't a Seahawk fan. Now, maybe that's a tiny bit OTT, but the sentiment, in my opinion, is bang on.
Not maybe not a Seahawks fan, but you never liked Richard Sherman to begin with. Now you've got an excuse not to like him. I think that's I'm looking forward to seeing him. He's still locking down the corner for a defense which is talent bereft pretty much on most spots on the defensive side of the ball. Akella Witherspoon's the guy standing opposite him who I really like coming out of Colorado a couple of years ago, but hasn't really made the step up. And obviously, apart from that, you got the D-line with Solomon Thomas, who's been pretty underwhelming so far. Then the two Oregon Ducks, defensive lineman DeForest Buckner, and the other guy, Arik Armstead, who just seemed to be a bit of a pain in the ass when we play them in the last couple of years. But they will be the main points, and Armstead and Buckner against DJ Fuka is going to be probably the go-to battle to watch on Sunday, isn't it, on that side of the ball? Outside of, obviously, Richard Sherman and Doug Baldwin, which could be, I hope, they're mic'd up on Sunday.
Yeah, that would be great. Look, for once, it hasn't happened many times this year, but I think there is a clear talent gap between the Seahawks and their opponents in the Seahawks' favour. And it'll be cool if they can kind of treat the Niners like they treated the Raiders and just do them in, you know, just beat them.
Exactly. Yeah. I think the Raiders game is a pretty spot on game to compare this one to. You'd hope with home comforts that it would be something which comes somewhat handily. Entering the game, though, the Seahawks are 11th in weighted DVOA, which is brings all things into consideration. 12th in scoring offense, 8th in scoring defense, have 75% playoff odds. And done that with a team which lost so many starters over the offseason and played so far what is the third hardest schedule in the NFL. Someone on Seahawks Twitter, who we refer to in the past, said for a couple of weeks, to be fair to him, in his, I don't know if it's wisdom, but it's in something, that the Seahawks are going to run the table. Do you think that's going to happen?
No, I think they'll get absolutely housed by the Chiefs.
Yeah.
But at that stage, I don't think it'll matter. I think we'll be in the playoffs already, so it'll kind of be a win-win situation for everyone.
Yeah, and Gordon asked on Twitter, who do we think the Seahawks would face? Who are they likely to face in the playoffs if that does come to fruition at the end of the year?
Well, I think you can pretty much guarantee it's going to be either the Bears or the Cowboys, to be honest, because the Saints and the Rams are definitely going to be 1 and 2 in whatever order. That's a guarantee. So they're in a bye. So you're going to face the winners. So the winners of the NFC East and North are going to be 3 and 4. So that is almost certainly going to be the Bears. And the way it's looking, probably going to be the Cowboys as well. So at that stage, you're looking at the Vikings, the Panthers, and the Seahawks as the three other teams. So I think it's going to be Dallas, because I have a feeling we might end up sneaking that fifth spot versus sixth, and I think the Cowboys will be fourth. So if you were going to book any optimistically early flights, I would say get yourself on Kayak or Skyscanner or whatever it's called and have a look at Dallas, as I may or may not have already done.
Yeah, I think we talked about the Vikings game. I picked that might be. I think that's going to be a bigger game for them, because I think they'll be chasing shadows. We are with the Rams. I think they'll be chasing the Bears shadow by that point. Obviously, it's only 10 days away. So I think that will be a bigger game for them, because the Panthers have to play the Saints twice in the final 3 weeks of the season, which is not going to be fun unless the hope we have for Kansas City where they rest their guys. But I don't see Andy Reid doing that in week 16. If it was week 17, maybe it's a different matter, because which is what he did last year with Mahomes and Alex Smith sat out week 17. I don't see that happening for that entire game in week 16. That's something we can talk to when the game comes around. But yeah, I think Dallas seems to be the likeliest one. Colt McCoy, bless his heart, tried his best, and he had a few impressive plays, but he just, that offense doesn't have the talent They've lost Paul Richardson, lost Jameson Crowder. Josh Doctson has been a bit of a disappointment. Jordan Reed can't stay healthy. Vernon Davis is kind of in and out of games at his time of his career as well. The O-line kind of has too many blow-ups to be a team. But defense is going to keep them in games. So if they can get Adrian Peterson back running again, you never know. But I do think the Cowboys are probably going to hold serve in the NFC East. But yeah, who knows? But I think, yeah, if you want to go anywhere, Dallas could be the place we're going to go. And then, oh boy, that could be fun if we get the sixth seed in the second week of the playoffs, if we manage to get through the first week, obviously. But another trip down to the Coliseum would be fun, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I don't normally like this stuff, but the Rams would not want to play the Seahawks again.
No, most definitely. I think the two teams the Rams want no part of the rest of the season. Well, no, probably three teams. I don't think they want to face the Saints again. I don't think they want to face us again. And I don't think they want to go against the Chiefs again. Because the Chiefs are winning that Monday night if they don't have the Mahomes turnovers. I mean, it's the first Mahomes turnover ever in his career at college or in the NFL that resulted in like a pick six or fumble touchdown. They're not going to make those same mistakes again. I think they're the three teams that they don't want to face. They're also the three teams that they're probably going to face at this point, so it could be fun. Confidence over Sunday, score prediction, confidence?
I think Seahawks by 11.
Well, yeah, I think by 16. I think I've got 33.
I'll go 27-16.
Okay, yeah, so obviously we'll come back next week. The Seahawks then play the Minnesota Vikings on Monday Night Football. I think that's right. I think it's Monday Night Football. I hope it's Monday Night Football. And then obviously back to go down to San Francisco to play the 49ers, Chiefs, and the Cardinals back in Seattle as well in week 17. But before that, it's just time for this week's bid.
First of all, this is an exciting time for our organization.
2017 Browns joined the 2008 Lions as the only teams to go 0-16.
Get in the bin.
Give me Josh Freeman, who was the 17th pick in the first round, over Cam Newton, who was the number one overall pick.
And the 2015 AP Most Valuable Player is Cam Newton.
Get in the bin.
Chip Kelly's an evolver, and he's a smart guy, and I think he's going to go to San Francisco and they're going to be a much more viable football franchise.
That the 49ers are expected to clean house and dismiss head coach Chip Kelly.
Get in the bin.
Get in the bin has plenty of people and plenty of potential. I think I'm going to go for one of my old favourites in the shit for. Well, it could be a number of people in the media who have kind of been cozied up to by a former NFL head coach who's now a special assistant at a flailing NFL franchise. Colin Cowherd's going to be the main point of my eye, who just cannot give up and admit that he was wrong about every aspect of both decided to take Hugh Jackson's side in what was a pretty refreshing take from Baker Mayfield, who had no intention of hugging or shaking the hand of Hugh Jackson after the Browns beat down on Cincinnati Bengals on Sunday, and a lot of that due to Baker Mayfield and David Njoku and Nick Chubb. And it's just, come on, Colin Cowherd especially, but Mike Silver. The fact that an NFL coach was fired and then did a media tour for 2 or 3 weeks before getting rehired by his whole team in the team he's just been fired from his division. And then the same people he visited are now the ones supporting him and backing him up against a rookie quarterback who, as Baker Mayfield himself said today, he's not the cookie-cutter quarterback, he's himself, and he's never going to change, which is, as I said, remarkably refreshing from some of the stuff we get from NFL quarterbacks, starting quarterbacks especially. So, yeah, just Colin Cowherd and all the media types who have been coached up to by a terrible, possibly the worst ever NFL head coach. Get in the bin, chaps. Adam?
I think that's a really good point, by the way, about the media tour, because that's probably the one thing that Hugh Jackson, if he hadn't done, you'd have a bit of sympathy for him. But the fact that the minute he got fired, he was straight on the media tour, first take, undisputed with hyenas like Skip Bayless, you know, that's where you can have little sympathy for Jackson. I think for me, fair enough, using the word Jackson, the Jacksonville Jaguars, and unfortunately Jalen, with his kind of jawing at Josh Allen with your trash stuff, whatever, if anything, what it shows is how remarkable a job the Seahawks did for 5 years being such a strong defense, because the Jaguars did it for 1 year, and even then they were good, but they still give up a load of points when it really mattered. But they have absolutely fallen off a cliff. And if they retain Blake Bortles or find a reason to do it, that's going to piss me off a lot, because his time there is done. They're in desperate need of a change. And yeah, I just think they can get in the bin, because they've gone about this whole season as if the 16 games they have to play are a waste of time. Just get us to January in the playoffs. But you soon realize that the reason some of the best teams are the best teams is that they churn through October, November, December and just pick up win after win after win. And they're never too arrogant to get those wins. And I feel the Jaguars all season, as soon as they beat the Patriots, the focus wasn't on week three or week four. It was on week 18 in the playoffs. And that I think deserves bin status.
I'd agree. Also for me, get the bin. I think it sounds like Bruce Allen at the Washington Redskins. A week ago, Colin Kaepernick was too much of a distraction to even bring him for a visit, which is clearly a quarterback-needy franchise after Alex was horrible injury a few weeks ago, but then seems fit to sign Reuben Foster and haul his baggage. And also after a couple of weeks where they did nothing and said nothing and defended Adrian Peterson, who admitted he still hits his kid. So all they need now is to sign a deal to play a game in Saudi Arabia, and they've got the full house, haven't they?
It's pretty shameful. We try not to key down on some of the more serious stuff too much, because it's supposed to be an enjoyable listen. But the level of hypocrisy in the NFL, firstly to good players versus bad players, also to what is objectively a bad thing to do versus someone's freedom of speech, which is apparently the First Amendment of the nation's constitution. It doesn't do it for me, I have to say. I find it very uneasy. And I think that the Redskins, to sign Reuben Foster, to stash him, basically on the off chance he might be available to play, given the fact that very few teams you would imagine are sat there waiting to jump at the chance to take him, I think it's an absolutely terrible look for the Redskins. You should be ashamed of themselves.
Yeah, and also the fact that the team released a statement where they said they got references from Alabama players on the team, and all bar one, who being Sean Dion Hamilton, no commented, said that they didn't get any conversations from the team on Reuben Foster. So it's all a bit of a nauseating situation in the nation's capital, even in sport and not just other things.
For the all-time bin, by the way, it is worth pointing out that if the Cincinnati Bengals fire Marvin Lewis and hire Hugh Jackson...
I told you.
That is bin of fame level.
I called it. As soon as I saw that, I was like, well, struck that one for me, because I called that. That is the most obvious thing that's ever, ever existed. Also, one more thing on that game, the opposite of getting a bin, Demarius Randle should get his gold jacket now after he intercepted Andy Dalton and ran over to the sideline and handed the ball to Hugh Jackson. It's just the best. That's the best troll ever. So well done, Demarius Randle. Also, before we get on to Locks and Shock and other NFL stuff, one more thing in the bin. The College Football Playoff Committee, who have Washington State at just two losses, one against just a ridiculously good and efficient defense last Friday night against the Huskies, are below three teams who have three losses and need a minor miracle to have a New York Six bowl, which after the season that Gardner Minshew, as we spoke to Jess last week, said a season for the ages, really, for the Washington State Cougars. The fact that they're not going to have the platform on the stage of a New York Six bowl game, the fact that they're not going to be going to probably not going down to Arizona and playing in the Fiesta Bowl is just an absolute joke, because they have to get the Michigans and the LSUs and all the rest of it just in that top 10, just because they're East Coast and their games are more watched by the people making decisions. The fact that the Cougars play at 3 o'clock or late 10 o'clock on the East Coast time it's not hard to watch Cougar games after the fact. Just go and watch that team this year. The fact that they're below, especially Michigan, who got absolutely hosed on Sunday, and LSU also had three losses and lost an absolute barn burner on Saturday night. It's just absolute nonsense. So they need to change the football playoff anyway, but they need to level the playing field somewhat, because it is definitely slanted to the SEC, Alabama, and further east than that, isn't it, Adam?
It's a nonsense. I think Brock Heward said that for there to be eight SEC teams in the top 25, it just really is a suggestion that these games are on TV a lot more. The stadiums are a lot more full than maybe any other division, so that there seems like a passion there, which is a point worth making, that, you know, some of the Pac-12 attendances have been pretty pathetic this year. But it's very silly that there's such an obvious East Coast bias, and the Pac and the Pac-12 themselves do nothing to help themselves out with their bowl game being at 5:20 on Friday evening in Santa Clara, where there's going to be no one there.
Yeah, no, and I think it might have been Brock Hughes as well. They posted that of all the conference bowl games in the FBS, the cheapest tickets on StubHub and secondary markets is the Pac-12 one, which you can get a ticket for $27.
$18 now you can get in the building.
It's $18. That's just absolutely ridiculous. I mean, it's an impossible place to get to at 5 o'clock on a Friday evening. It's an impossible place to get to at 4 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, let alone anything else. So, yeah, it's a farce of a conference, but they also at the same time deserve a bit more leeway, especially with the story and how the Cougars played for all bar one game, really, wasn't it? And that was this past. I mean, even the loss they had before the Huskies was all down to just absolute nonsense officiating by Pac-12 refs.
Yeah, that was against Oregon. Against USC.
So yeah, so the fact that they're not going down to Arizona is absolute sham. But also talking to the Huskies, oof, that was quite impressive defensively, wasn't it? And obviously Myles Gaskin went out in the best way possible, and it's just it's weird how much more fun watching run plays break out 50 yards is when he's running through the snow, isn't it? It's a weird, weird thing.
Snow's always great to watch sport. any kind of watching games at a stupid time of night, or, you know, with ridiculous weather, is always great fun. And yeah, I mean, that was a heck of a win. I think the snow did play a part, not 13 points or 14 points difference, but it certainly didn't help. And it gave Washington just that maybe a little bit of advantage that they needed to get the job done. But they should be proud of themselves, because that was a hell of an effort.
Yeah, it really was. And obviously, they'll now play Utah at Santa Clara on Friday for the right to represent the Pac-12 and probably the Rose Bowl, and you'd expect against Ohio State, which could be fun to end Urban Meyer's, but possibly could be his collegiate career. If Rich Eisen people, Bruce Feldman seemed to be hinting that last week about his concerns over his health. Lock and shot, Adam, quickly.
Lock and shot. Have you even got the schedule up in front of me? Who would have thought?
I mean, I think the lock of the week, I mean, there is one, but I don't want to do that to them. I think I'm going to go to Chiefs at the Raiders.
That seems very fair. And I think also maybe not. I think the Packers owns the Cardinals is a lock, in fairness.
Yeah. Shock of the week, Adam?
It's difficult to find like out and out shocks these days, but I do feel like if you thought at the start of the season the Colts would go into Jacksonville and beat the Jaguars, that would seem a huge shock. Probably the same as the Bears going into New York and beating the Giants, that would seem a big shock. But I think overall, if I had to do like an actual what may happen that could be fairly shocking, I think the Chargers going to Pittsburgh and winning is not beyond the realms of possibility.
No. Marvin Gordon's status is probably a big part of
that. That's true. And this is a huge game for the Patriots as well, at home to the Vikings. I mean, it's out of conference. It doesn't matter in terms of the standings or whatever. But I think people, for the first time ever, there are legitimate concerns about the Patriots. I think Brady looks like he could be actually slowing up. And it'll be very interesting to see how he does against a defense like Minnesota, who, although they've not been as good as we may have thought this year, they still have legitimate talent.
Yeah. I mean, saying about Brady seems to be slowing up, his throw to Gronkowski is
amazing.
It's perfect. It's the fact that he can still do that at his age is quite big. Yeah, there doesn't seem to be that aura around this Patriots team. And to be fair, there probably wasn't before, but as someone put on Twitter last year, the Patriots only play two games every season, the AFC title game and Super Bowl. So maybe that's when they'll turn it on. My shock of the week, I'm just changing the pick on our pick, Adam, because I've just realised I've got it the other way around. I think the Bills are going to beat the Dolphins.
Ooh, that'd be a great shout.
Yeah, because I think Josh Allen just seems to be someone who's the NFL hasn't really, the kind of constantly surprised with the fact that he got 98 rush yards on Sunday as they beat the Jets.
The Bills beat the Jaguars.
I thought it was a Jets. Who beat the
Patriots? Yeah,
the Jets. So I do. Okay, that's where I had the Jets in my brain. Yeah, I do think the Jets. I'm slowly stepping off onto the curb off the Dolphins bandwagon. I think the way they give that game up against the Colts, which is just that is one team. If I'm an AFC team, I do not want them in the playoffs. If I do not want to face the Colts in the playoffs, because that offense is playing at a pretty high level, and Quentin Nelson, Mark Glinski are the new. Zach Martin and Leo Collins, whoever it was in Dallas a few years ago, they are monstering over people. It's pretty fun to watch. So yeah, I think that would be everything. Anything else? Other NFL stuff, Adam?
I think we're good. Been a good season this year, hasn't it? It's been a better season than the last couple. Certainly last year, which was a bit flat. There's been a lot of good stuff going on this year. It's my cleat, my cause this week, so there should be some interesting stuff going on players' feet in the pregame warm-up, so I look forward to seeing some of that.
Yeah, and also one thing on that, a big bit of a shout-out, I'm not going to hear this, but Denver Broncos wide receiver River Craycraft.
He might listen.
Who used to play collegiately for the Washington State Cougars, obviously knew Tyler Helinski pretty well, I'd imagine, and he's going to be adorning the Helinski hope and his cleat for cause. His cause for cleats, whichever way around it is for the Helinski Hope Foundation, which is pretty cool after all the work we've done. So it'd be pretty cool to see that on Sunday evening. If you want to get in touch with us, you can at usual places, possessionpodcast.podbean.com, the Possession Podcast on Facebook, at Seahawkers UK on Twitter, UK Seattle Seahawks fans on Facebook, UK Seahawkers on Instagram as well. All the personal stuff you should know by now if you're listening, because this is our 80th episode. We've somehow managed to ruse people into thinking we're somewhat semi-capable and we've got to 80, Adams, which is pretty
cool. About 100 hours of your time we've wasted, dear listeners. How must you feel?
Yeah.
Keep listening, please. Keep listening and tell your friends.
80 sleepless nights while trying to figure out why. To be fair, we probably hit 100 with all the failed recordings we've had.
Oh, maybe 180.
Yeah, and just one more note I've just found scribbled down somewhere. I actually did take notes for this one, and that's how bored I've been today. David Moore and Chris Carson were seventh round picks in 2017. Apart from Elijah Maguire, who has a pretty impressive amount of yards, no other player in the sixth or seventh round has that as many yards as Moore and Chris Carson do, and only George Kittle and Aaron Jones, who were fifth round picks in 2017, have more yards, but only Aaron Jones has more touchdowns. And then over his career, David Moore has touched the ball 22 times for 413 yards and 5 touchdowns. Carson is 210 touches, 990 yards and 5 touchdowns. Kittle has 99 touches for 1,338 yards and 5 touchdowns. But Aaron Jones, which just kind of makes whatever's happening in Green Bay seem a bit strange, has 210 touches, 1,238 yards and 11 touchdowns. So we talked about, I mentioned John Schneider, there's a lot of credit. If you start at the start of the seventh round in 2017 and go from there, it's not looking like a bad crop of players he's brought in and infused into his team, is it?
Not yet. Not at all. And long may that continue, because we've not got many picks next year. And so if we trade out of the ones that we do have, we're going to need to find some late gems again.
Yeah, most definitely. So enjoy the weekend. Enjoy wherever you watch the game. Enjoy Sean and Mark and obviously everyone else who's making a trip out to Seattle to watch this game at CenturyLink Field. I think I'll speak for them. We are very, very jealous that you are doing that this weekend and you haven't managed to find the money that back of the server to pay for us to come with you. But wherever you watch the game, from whatever corner of the world you watch the game, whatever corner of the world you watch Alabama beat another team by 20 or more points, this has been the Pedestrian Podcast.
Vamos Hawks.
That's just something that we've been working on. So the fact that it came out and I had a chance to do it, it was great.
That was an exquisite job of holding space and everything by David to make his play. It's a great throw. The execution was just gorgeous.